Welcome to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. The federal government's credit appears in a deep swerve. Golden treasuries have seriously diverged, but I'm ducking you nerds while I'm plucking your nerves. Damn, I'm entangled in all of them facts. I'm calling your credit, so give the wampum back. I'm evolving forever like a quantum cat. Stop the track, check your soul, I'ma bonk them hacks. Cause I'm building for the future, only time will tell. Your bitcoins aren't yours unless you sign yourself, so then you really own them like the guy Rindell. Expecto Patronum, see I'll try a spell. Catch me in the office, ready, fixing the yell. Steady ringing the bell and building up a citadel. Take a sip and wail, stumble down the rabbit hole, flipping every habit till we're deep inside the magical here on Galaxy Brains. As always, I'm your host, Alex Thorne, head of research at Galaxy. Thank you for listening to Galaxy Brains. We have a great show for you today. As I said, Rindell, CTO of Taproot Wizards, is our guest. We'll get into it deep with him about Taproot Wizards, the project, what they're working on, what they've already done. We'll also talk at length with him about the Bitcoin improvement proposal process, Bitcoin upgrades, Bitcoin culture, and the future of Bitcoin in general. Of course, we'll check in with our good friend, Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always, to talk markets. And before we get to all that, I need to remind you to please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes, and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. Let's hop right into the show. Let's go now to our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bimnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me on.
I love having you on. And it's been kind of an exciting, like, I mean, Bitcoin's mostly like ranging still, but in macro, we had a lot of data this week. We had ISM and ADP, and it looked like there was, even Bitcoin was recovering a bit in the beginning of the week, but then on the back of some of the numbers, it, and as well as stocks and other things, came down a decent amount. Not like a ton, but, you know, what's happening? Why?
So after quarter end, you had a pretty dramatic repricing of the rate complex. In the front end, with respect to how many cuts were priced in, and the back end, with respect to how much term premium is priced in. What drove that was a series of, you know, hot numbers that you got, you know, earlier this week, and things like ISM manufacturing that showed strength, and in, you know, other pieces of economic data. And so you started the quarter with, you know, a pretty insane move in back-end treasuries.
Yep.
And part of it was a function of positioning, quarter-end flows that were geared towards buying. And you generally there's just a lot of noise around quarter-end and stuff. And so you got a ton of hawkish Fed speak, a bunch of hot data, and that caused the rate market to reprice. And that, in turn, caused other markets to reprice. More specifically, U.S. equities, you know, they had, you know, some of their biggest trading ranges they've had all year. NASDAQ, you know, yesterday at the lows was down 1.5%. I don't remember the last 1% day in NASDAQ. That's how long it's been, to the downside at least. And so, you know, I think what's happened today is you had a little bit of soft data. So you've had a retracement in some of those trades. You know, basically ISM services prices paid came in soft today, and services is obviously, you know, 60-70% of the U.S. economy. So when service prices go down, that's generally a constructive sign for prices. However, I think the most notable thing in markets this week has been really the strength in the commodity complex. Mm-hmm. You can start with gold. That's trading at all-time highs, where every dip is continuing to get bought. And that's in the face of risk markets that were trading poorly, in the face of a dollar that's relatively well bid, and in the face of real rates, which have historically been the largest driver, from a mathematical perspective of gold, that are elevated. And so you would think that real rates elevated, moving higher, like gold should be moving down, but it's been the opposite. Mm-hmm. And other precious metals like silver are trading really well on the back of that.
So it's not just cocoa, which is
mooning. No, cocoa is mooning too. But and then copper is trading really well And that, you know, is a function of, you know, a lack of supply, and more demand is a function of kind of the stimulus efforts in China. And so you've had, you know, real world assets, pardon the crypto pun.
Actual physical
like things, yeah. Trade really well. And when you see that happening in the context of a rate curve that is steepening and putting in higher term premium, it kind of makes you think about the terminal state of monetary policy and the terminal state of fiscal, because part of the reason why, you know, the back end is steepening so much relatively is because the government is still printing $2 trillion deficits, right? We're adding $1 trillion every 100 days,
right,
to the national deficit. And so there's a ton of bonds that have to get, you know, absorbed by the market. In addition, right, like with all this stimulus, et cetera, fiscal impulse, like inflation's probably going to stay high. And that's what we've kind of seen, and especially with the commodity complex doing what it's doing. And so you need to be compensated for a higher rate of inflation in those back end bonds.
In the future, yeah.
And then in addition, you know, there's a lot of commentary around what neutral rate is. What is the baseline for the Fed going forward? Is neutral 2.5%, or is it closer to 3, maybe even higher? And so the idea of long run interest rates being higher on average, tons of supply in the back end that needs to get absorbed by the market as well, is really pushing yields higher. And so when you see that in the context of gold that is trading really well, I think, you know, the way I would interpret that is the market's really worried that at the end of all of this, it just means more Fed printing, more inflation, a ton more debt, and monetary debasement.
Yeah.
Really the fundamentals of why we like Bitcoin manifesting themselves in the real market.
So you think the realization is really starting to hit home now? It's not just us. It's not the gold bugs any longer. It's becoming widespread.
And I think part of that is a function of some more prominent folks in the financial community, you know, highlighting this. It's not just, you know, Stan Druckenmiller giving the same speech from 2018 anymore.
Right.
It's Ken Griffin. Ray Dalio. It's Jamie Dimon.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, you know, not fundamentally, but technically, I think it's really hard for folks to ignore, like, really scalable assets that are performing this way. When a macro manager sees gold ripping and he can put billions of dollars into it,
yeah,
the question is, why haven't you put billions of dollars into it?
Right.
Is the move justified?
Right.
And obviously it is.
Yeah.
Because all, like, macro folks, you know, see the debasement argument, right, et cetera.
It's sort of like, if you don't do it, you're actively taking the counter view.
Correct.
And that, based on everything we're seeing, like, that'd be kind of crazy at this point to take the counter view.
Because the math doesn't add up.
Yeah. It's become conventional wisdom now that the math doesn't add up, is your point. It's not a niche.
It's not niche.
Yeah.
And
if you look at the long-term bonds versus gold, like, historically trade similarly, mm-hmm, over long periods of time, they've traded both as hedges, right?
Yes.
And since 2020, they've diverged dramatically. Gold continuing up and bonds just
up,
down.
Absolutely.
Which is, I mean, it's, I hit max on the terminal on the chart, and, like, it was the same in all of history, basically, except for now. So yeah, it's pretty glaring.
It's insane. And, you know, the more that everyday people wake up to it, and not just financial markets folks, you know, the higher this stuff goes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always been of the theory that the best way to hedge yourself and protect your purchasing power in the future, right, is with, you know, real world assets and you know, monetary debasement hedges, homes, gold, mm-hmm, Bitcoin, and tech stocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's, yeah, really the ultimate, like, right, protect your purchasing power over the long run. And that's what we're here to do, you know, with Bitcoin and cryptos, is really enhance that store of value. And so, you know, I think this is a story that you just have to let play out over time. And folks are just going to be looking at gold at 3,000, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
You know, in the near or medium term. And hopefully that means Bitcoin will trade higher in conjunction.
It's like, do we think either of the presidential candidates are likely to change this in the next? No, right?
It
probably not.
That's So you're spot on. Neither of the presidential candidates are really going to make any difference
to
the fiscal situation.
There's that great scene in Arrested Development when he's like, people always think that they can change it, but they're always wrong, except maybe we could change it. And it's like, they're not going to, right? I mean,
there was that Cantor Fitzgerald piece today.
A tough fix. The fiscal and monetary situation will be a tough fix politically, was what the headline said.
Yeah.
And that's the understatement of a lifetime.
Exactly, right? And the economy that we need to live in is the political economy as well. And so there is no appetite to cut Medicare, Social Security,
and raise taxes.
There is no appetite.
Neither side wants to do – I mean
– you don't get elected by telling people they're getting less money
and paying more. You're paying more and getting less services,
correct.
Theoretically.
And just generally,
can we grow our way out of it? Isn't that one of those concepts? We're too deep in the hole, you think, for one of those arguments?
You're past the point of no return.
You know, what about an AI revolution that like—
productivity gains, yes.
Right, but massive ones, right? But it would have to be massive at this point.
It would have to
be
insane.
Yeah.
And traditionally, the arguments around why the U.S. can continue to spend this much is because, you know, they are the bellwether of innovation.
Yeah.
Right, California itself is like the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world.
Right, right,
right. And so, you know, historically we have been able to do that, and the folks respect the U.S. government, so it has taxing power. It's not like Greece where nobody pays taxes; people pay their taxes here.
Yeah,
and so it's always been like the U.S. has the ability to tax its way into a much healthier situation. But does that really exist in the political economy that we live in now? And once the issue is that world was in a world where interest rates were low, right? And now the servicing of the debt has grown so huge that it's become like really untenable and unsustainable. And so that's what's different now is you have this inflation problem. So you're paying 5% and change on T-bills. And that's 20% of the treasury supply.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you have to pay that interest, in addition to the services that you need to pay for, the math just continually gets worse and worse. And you don't have to trust me on the math. Just look at the CBO's projections of where the deficit's going to be and their assumptions, et cetera. And it's really bad. You're talking about $200+ trillion of unfunded liabilities that the government currently has. We don't have the money. You can't print that much money without severe unintended consequences. And, you know, when you put that understanding into markets, it should mean that gold's higher. It should mean that silver's higher. It should mean that Bitcoin's at fresh all-time highs.
Yep. Tricky situation, getting trickier, but I guess you got to protect your purchasing power some way or another, and that's why you see the commodity complex. That's why stocks are still basically at all-time highs.
You know, absolutely. Right? And what you have to think about is just the price level of things, right? Like if we're talking about COVID, the price level was 100, right? Since then, like the price level is probably up 20% and change, right?
Yeah.
And that's official measurements, and other people are like, it's 30%, whatever.
Right.
And so what the Fed's focused on is getting that price level to go from 120 to 122, right? Versus what everyday Americans are focused on is the fact that their $1 item that they used to buy or $100 item that used to buy 2 years ago cost them 120 or 125.
Yeah.
And their incomes haven't necessarily kept up to that huge, huge price level gain. And so, you know, like there's a real mismatch of like what the ivory tower Fed officials are looking at versus what everyday Americans are feeling.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that's going to get resolved.
I don't either. It doesn't. We've talked about this before. Solving inflation almost guaranteed does not mean prices go down. It means the rate of growth in prices slows.
Correct.
The rate of growth slows.
Which is a lot different.
It's a lot different. People, we're never going back probably, right?
I'm never going back.
Yeah, because that's deflation.
And
the Fed tells us that's even worse.
And the idea that the Fed's talking about doing 3 cuts this year, I'm like, on what planet? Like, you really doing that? The data is insanely hot. what are people, people are just going to buy mortgages and stuff, buy houses.
It's going to push inflation.
It's going to push inflation.
Any easing in those rates there is going to send people right to the market to buy, right? I mean.
And so that's the issue you currently have. And that's why it's hard to be bearish any of these things that are doing well right now.
Bimnet Abibi, my friend from Galaxy Trading, as always, thanks for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's go now to our guest, Rindell, CTO of Taproot Wizards. My friend, thank you for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you because you are the technical master behind the Taproot Wizards. Is that a fair thing, a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization, yeah.
It is strange seeing you in person because we've interacted and I followed you on Twitter for a long time.
Yeah.
But even when you're in person, I can't see your face. You are obscured, sir.
Yeah, that's the... magical internet money.
So, I guess before we get into it, we have a bunch of fun topics. I'm going to ask you about what Taproot Wizards is working on in the existing projects, but maybe you can give us some hints about what you have coming in the future. But before we get to that, I'd love you to tell our audience and me some of your background and how you got from wherever you started to Taproot Wizards.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, most of my career has been at this weird intersection of distributed systems, large-scale internet infrastructure, security, and it's been security focused either on networking or on what I would call applied cryptography. So, you know, how do we use encryption and signing at scale to, you know, secure systems or secure data or provide guarantees about things? So, spent a lot of time working on like really large scale cloud infrastructure, spent a decent amount of time like deploying cryptography at scale through appliances or like interesting applications. Decided I've been kind of in and out of Bitcoin for a long time and decided in, I don't know, 2020 that I, you know, wanted to stop doing side of desk projects and kind of nights and weekends Bitcoin stuff and wanted to work on it full time. So I ended up going and working full time on a non-custodial wallet that is really aimed at like normies, right? Like you don't have to be obsessed with Bitcoin to use this wallet. and worked on that for about a year and a half. Ordinals, you know, popped off and I got involved with Udi and Eric and Farr on Taproot Wizards, you know, first very like nights and weekends and kind of side of desk and then ended up, you know, taking the leap and joining the circus in November.
Love it. So, yeah. And for those who may not know, Taproot Wizards, what is it? How do we describe this?
It's an education company. We are teaching Bitcoiners how Bitcoin works.
I like that. You have... some of the vehicles that you've used are NFT collections, right? The Wizards, Taproot Wizards first one.
Yeah.
They're based on Farr's original magic internet money, right? Is that Farr? No.
So the original meme was done by Mavenspot.
Yeah,
and it was an advertisement for the Bitcoin subreddit in 2013.
Magic internet money, join us.
That's right.
With the Wizard.
And then Farr, who's a really well-known NFT artist, took that design and riffed on it and made this 4 megabyte wizard that we inscribed last February. Yeah, February. And that was the first 4 megger. It was the largest Bitcoin block ever, largest inscription, largest transaction in terms of V-bytes. And then we built a whole series. And, you know, I said that we're a Bitcoin education company that's like half joking, half serious. The way that we see the company is our mission is to make Bitcoin magical, you know, either magical or magical again, I guess, depending on your perspective. We think, among other things, that NFTs, inscriptions are a really, really powerful mechanism to organize a community and to get people to care about things and engage with things in like fun ways that they might not otherwise engage in. So, you know, after we inscribed the original Wizard collection, we made a series of quests that people had to do to try to get on the whitelist or to try to earn the opportunity to acquire a wizard. And, you know, some of the quests involve things like download a Lightning wallet and make a $2 donation to the Human Rights Foundation. So we had all these people that were like Solana and Ethereum collectors that maybe they've never actually done an on-chain Bitcoin transaction at all. Like they have no exposure to this. They might not have even heard of Lightning. And we had something like $20,000 in a weekend we raised for the Human Rights Foundation Bitcoin Development Fund. And we had all these people in our Telegram saying, wow, this is so fast, this is so easy, like I wanna learn more about this.
Wow.
So they're engaging with Bitcoin in a way that they haven't before. Or for the Quantum Cats collection, we had people go and learn about OpCat, which I think we're gonna talk about.
Yeah.
And you know, we have lots more ways that we want people to learn about and engage with OpCat, but you know, we've had people who have never looked at computer code before, they've like never, they don't know what Bitcoin script is, are now going and doing research and learning about how Bitcoin smart contracts work and learning about how Bitcoin script works and learning what opcodes are. And, you know, we're getting people to engage with Bitcoin in ways that they haven't before. And we're doing that in a way that's like very fun and whimsical.
Yeah, it is fun and whimsical. Yeah. I personally think it is quite fun and whimsical. There's controversy, right? There's a lot of Bitcoiners who prefer, whether it's Taproot Wizards in particular, but I think it's really inscriptions broadly, or we could even generalize it further and say non-financial, non-transaction data, arbitrary data, they think is spam on the blockchain, right? Obviously, Luke Dash Jr., I think, is the most outspoken sort of Bitcoin developer
who's opposed to it.
How do you view that? Is this the... They are using Bitcoin. Are they using it properly?
Well, I mean, so... I fall into the camp of, you know, if you pay the fee and your transaction is conformant to consensus rules, then it's a valid Bitcoin transaction. Something that I think people might not completely understand is, you know, you inscribe an image or whatever one time that puts, you know, data in the witness field of a transaction. And then after that, when you're trading it or transferring it or putting it in cold storage or putting it on an open dime or whatever, those are just, you know, I'm going to say normal. Those are normal Bitcoin transactions where you're just, you know, paying UTXOs and creating new UTXOs. So, you know, I think it's not really, some people might think that there's sort of this like ongoing data movement burden that happens, and there's not. I think something that's also really interesting is, you know, you can't do a Bitcoin atomic swap for like a car or for a sandwich or for a pupusa or something, right? Like Bitcoin only knows about things that are on the blockchain.
Right.
So having collectibles or other assets on the Bitcoin blockchain means that you can encumber them with Bitcoin logic. Like you can do an atomic swap. You can say you only get the Quantum Cat after this time lock or if you pay me the right amount of money. And there aren't a lot of transaction types that you can do with Bitcoin today. There aren't a lot of goods that you can buy and sell in a trustless open market that way. I think it's also the case that you know, people will only use a new tool over an incumbent tool if the new tool is like way better than the existing thing. Like the traditional product thinking is that if you want to knock over an incumbent, the new thing has to be like 10 times better.
Yep.
For most people, Bitcoin payments are not 10 times better than using Cash App or Venmo or Zelle or whatever you have. Bitcoin for savings, if you want to use like the digital gold use case, like probably is more than 10 times better than the next best thing. That's why it's found purchase in that use case. You know, inscriptions like digital artifacts on Bitcoin are 10x better than their competitors on other blockchains, and collecting or speculating on, or whether it's for conspicuous consumption or patronage or collecting or speculation, like buying and selling digital goods with Bitcoin is something that you can't do with normal traditional fiat money. And so it's it's more than 10 times better. It's infinity better than the alternative. So I don't know, I've kind of drifted from the question,
but I
think it's sort of like, you know, like it or not, Bitcoin is going to be popular for the use cases that it's good for. It's been good for some things in the past. It hasn't been good for everything. And this is something that Bitcoin is incredibly good at. And so as long as there's market demand for it, it's going to happen. And you can, you know, cry on Twitter all you want, but like people are going to do it.
So one of the, you said among other things, I think you make a strong case for the usage of Bitcoin for digital artifacts and mm-hmm. how that enables interesting types of transactions and economic activity that,
yeah.
I mean, frankly, is happening on other blockchains, right?
Yep.
And could happen, has happened in the past. But one of the things you mentioned was that your view is that if a transaction conforms to the consensus rules, then mm-hmm. then it's valid, right? If it pays mm-hmm. the fees, if it is structured in the correct format, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
What about the... I haven't heard anyone really proposing altering the consensus rules to get rid of inscriptions.
Yeah, I mean, people have, on Christmas Day, I wrote an 80-line shell script that would reject blocks that include inscriptions.
Right, but just from your node, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, if you get the economic majority to run that code, then
right.
they're now on a different chain. And if you get miners to mine
You're
on
right.
top of it, then that's Bitcoin now. I think, you know, people have kicked around if you wanted to get rid of this, you would have to do something like whitelist specific shapes of transactions and like only allow them. There's a slippery slope there because you can embed data in raw pub keys.
Right.
So like you can always fit data.
What stamps does? Is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Stamps. And by the way, people have been doing that for years, right?
Like yeah, people have been
having
doing it for years.
Like invalid outputs in mm-hmm. your transaction, right? So like.
Well, I mean, the thing that's really wild is you can actually embed data in valid pub keys. So you can take a valid pub key, tweak it with some data, and it's still a valid pub key if it's on the curve.
Is that basically how like a tap tweak works?
It's exactly how tap tweak works.
So point being though, is there's other ways to do this.
There's other ways. I mean, I think the fair question is whether or not you can build a viable market on top of those other ways. You know, part of the reason why inscriptions took off, one of the things that I hope people learn from Casey is that simplicity in implementation matters. Like inscriptions are a relatively simple protocol. And so, you know, people were able to very quickly build wallets and marketplaces and explorers and all these things. And you got a whole ecosystem and like you need an ecosystem around a market.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to steel man the other side of it, if you forced people to only do like tweaking of, you know, Schnorr pub keys or something for data, is that complex enough that it you know, inhibits economic growth? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it does seem so not having proposed that I've heard really any concrete, but yours is being the only one, the block, what was the name that you had a name for that? You also, actually, hold on, well, what is the?
Well, so the name of the project is Bitcoin Purifier.
Yeah, Purifier.
And
yeah.
Then the name of the actual script is geld.sh. Not everybody knows, like, geld yeah. is a verb. You should look it up.
Yeah, yeah. It means castration, right?
It does, yeah.
So that's funny. So you've put it out. You also put out another project called the Sophon.
I did, yeah.
Which was, I guess, named after the three-body problem, right?
That's right.
Great book. The show was pretty good too. Have you watched it?
I was pleasantly surprised.
Me
by the
too.
Show.
I'm
yeah,
quite
I thought
excited.
It was gonna be horrible.
I love that. It's great sci-fi.
Xi Jin
Liu wrote that. Great books.
Yeah.
But the Sophon that you created would what? It would spy in the mempool on BRC20 mm-hmm. mint transactions.
Technically, what's called a deploy transaction, which is like creating a new token.
And it would create it first with mm-hmm. what, a supply of one
max
or something?
Max supply of one.
Yeah, right. So it would basically brick
yep.
new BRC20 token launches.
Yeah, yeah. I described it as I did like an involuntary conversion to an NFT.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a one of one. Because one of the complaints, I've had this too, I mm-hmm. happen to think that BRC20 is a pretty poor token protocol in the scheme
I agree.
Of things.
Yeah.
People have blamed the Taproot Wizards, partly because maybe because Udi and Eric have done such a good job promoting Taproot Wizards as sort of one of the main faces of inscriptions.
Yeah.
But you guys haven't done a BRC20 or anything, right?
No. We have not.
Yeah.
We've never said that we would.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever will.
Well, and
we
now
have
we've
no
got
plans to.
I want to ask you about runes too, but does that enable better fungible tokens than BRC20 or is that
I
something
think
different?
So I mean, so BRC20 is sort of just bad for a bunch of reasons. And You know, one of the things that's annoying about it from like a noisy neighbor perspective, right, is, you know, if you have, so every time you want to mint a BRC20 token, it's 2 on-chain transactions because this mint message is an inscription. So there being an opportunity for, you know, 40,000 BRC20 mint inscriptions means that you're going to see 80,000 on-chain transactions. And on top of that, you can have something which is an invalid BRC20 mint, but is still a valid Bitcoin transaction. Mm-hmm. So it still goes into a block. It still consumes block space. So what the SOFON did was, yeah, it found tokens that were queued up to be deployed, meaning created, and then it would basically set their max issuance to 1. And it successfully bricked, I think the number was something like 266 BRC20 tokens.
But that costs money to operate, right? Because you're paying transaction fees to basically
and
front
I have
run
to outbid
mints.
Them. Yeah, I have to pay more. So
yeah.
Rob Hamilton kicked in, I think like $5 or $10. Somebody else threw in a few dollars. I put like $500 into it or something. In retrospect, what I should have done is I should have taken the now dead BRC20 tokens and made a collection out of it and sold it and used that money to fund the operation. What I did, like an idiot, was I just, you know, took these now defunct tokens and threw them into Cash App and then got, you know, clean sats back out again. And so, you know, somebody's going to take their DCA out of Cash App and like have a surprise.
So Cash App custody, which they built themselves, I recall, has some random old BRC20 sats in there.
Oh yeah. They've got a lot of stuff. last year I was in a bunch of meetings, at my previous job, like back to back. And so, I made a little game of, I would take some money out of Cash App and inscribe Craig Wright is a liar and a fraud a couple hundred times and then put them back in Cash App and then get it back out again and did that in a loop. I kind of, my mental model for this is it's like scattering seeds into the wind. Like somebody's going to get these sats out of Cash App one day and be like, yeah,
what is this thing? Yeah that's great. Interesting. So I want to ask too about, okay, so not no consensus change that I've seen, but we have seen the data carrier size limit change, which is effectively a filter, right? This is what they
A lot of fix the filters. Interest on filters.
What is that? Can you explain what the filters are and what what impact they theoretically could have?
Yeah. So the idea is
again, an idea to block inscriptions or inhibit their growth or whatever. This is from an anti-inscription grad.
It's to prevent them from getting into blocks. So the idea is. And I'll give you like the steel man version of it's a dumb idea, but I'll give you like the best version of it. So you know, I want to inscribe something. Like we, you know, take a picture here in the studio, I want to put it on the blockchain to, you know, immortalize it forever. So I go to my Bitcoin node, I make these 2 transactions, what's called a commit and then a reveal that's in the sort of inscription parlance, and I broadcast them to the P2P network. Bitcoin nodes relay those transactions, and then eventually they find their way to a miner, and miner includes them in a block. The idea is that they want to have everybody's nodes not relay those transactions. So the idea is that if you wanted to make an inscription, you'd have to do something like go straight to a miner. So, you know, I think in the naive version of this plan is this will stop inscriptions. The more sophisticated version of it is it won't actually stop inscriptions, but it'll, you know, raise the cost of doing them to be sufficiently high that it, you know, drowns out the market and the market like doesn't come back. I think there's a bunch of problems with this argument. One of them is I looked on like a Dune dashboard. Last year, there was $250 million paid in fees to miners to inscribe things. And that's like on chain. That doesn't include out of band payments. So, you know, $250 million, not in, you know, revenue from inscription projects, like the actual, you know, value of those inscriptions is going to be some multiple higher than that. This is like people are willing to pay this as cost of goods sold to inscribe this data, which means that there is strong market demand for people to get these transactions into blocks, We've seen, you know, Marathon has a service around this now.
Yeah, they call it Slipstream.
Slipstream.
Yep.
There's other miners that will take transactions out of band. You know, like there's some mining pools that you, you know, send the CEO a serialized transaction over Telegram and it will get into a block.
Yep.
So on top of that, you know, there's whole services, like software as a service services that do nothing but provide a really friendly front end for inscribing things.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of collections do. So what ends up happening is if you are successful in widely deploying filters, which like I'll say in a minute why that will never be the case, but if you were somehow successful, it's not the case that every inscription, you know, fan out there needs to go and like do something exotic. What needs to happen is a small number of service providers need to strike deals with mining pools, which is very, you know, it's a very clear business case why they would do that. And then they say, hey, come use my easy point and click web application. You can pay with Lightning and I will get your inscriptions into a block. So it doesn't actually provide like a meaningful barrier to inscriptions. On top of that, you know, we actually saw a really interesting mempool filtering natural experiment last year. So there's a mempool policy called full RBF, where the way that nodes originally would relay transaction was what was called the first seen policy. So the way that this works is, say that you go to send me some Bitcoin on chain, and you realize, oh no, like the fee isn't high enough. I need to do a replace by fee, an RBF transaction, but you didn't mark your original transaction as RBF eligible. If you tried to send the second transaction to bump the fee, nodes would refuse to relay it. They would drop it. So Peter Todd wrote a patch to introduce a new mode called full RBF that lets you pass this RBF transaction even if the original did not signal for it. So when less than, I'm going to fudge the numbers, but they're the right order of magnitude, when there was something like 10% of the network running that patch, those transactions reliably got to miners. Reliably. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that and then invert it, it means if you want to stop a class of transactions from happening, you need more than 90% of the network running it. And yeah, we actually know that you need more than that because there's a new project out called Libre Relay, which further relaxes some policies. And a handful of people are running that. I ran a node. I don't know how many people are running it, but I'm guessing you can count it on two hands. And I was able to inscribe a transaction with multiple op returns, which is not allowed by normal relay policy. And I was also able to put a base64 encoded dick butt into an op return and get that into a block. And so if you have a small number of well-connected nodes who are economically motivated, you can get any consensus valid transaction into a block reliably. Yeah. So, you know, this idea that, yeah, we're just gonna, you know, merge a PR into Bitcoin Core and like this problem is going to go away is mm-hmm. completely ignoring the fact that, you know, this is not a spam attack to try to attack the network. This is a market and there's economic demand for this activity.
Interesting. I do hear still a lot of complaining about this. I will say it was nice to see, you know, one of the there are some pitfalls aside from the fact that it wouldn't be effective at achieving their stated ends of halting or slowing or killing inscriptions. There are some big drawbacks to doing this as well, right?
Yeah.
I've been saying this too. I've been saying, frankly, I'm relatively ambivalent on this, except that the drawbacks to me are quite negative. So like that's why
I think
why
the drawbacks are way worse. And you know, it's
so
really,
yeah, what are the drawbacks?
I mean, if it was successful, which I think, you know, I've laid out my belief for like why it would not be successful,
right.
But if it were successful, then I think what would end up happening is, you know, the Bitcoin mining is a permissionless system. Like the part of the reason why Bitcoin is valuable and useful is because you can, you know, plug an S19 into a waterfall somewhere and you can start mining.
You can show up and compute it by hand, theoretically.
In theory, right?
Yeah.
And I think what you want in order for Bitcoin mining to stay permissionless and decentralized is you want, you know, any miner who shows up to have access to the same flow of transactions as any other miner, right? What you don't want is you don't want to end up in a situation where you have to be like in a permissioned set in order to get the most valuable transactions to mine, because then that permission set is pulling in a disproportionate amount of mining revenue and can turn that into deployed CapEx and deploy hash rate faster and grow faster than everybody
else. Miner centralization is one of the big takeaways. And what you're saying is if you make it impossible for us to go through the public mempool where everyone can see it, including the miners, then we all start going, the users who are wanting to do this activity, the inscriptions, they all start going to Slipstream by Marathon or to Luxor or to whomever, and these guys make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And now random miner has no opportunity to make that money.
Yep.
So then they become the accepting ones become big. What about the argument too that this is one that that is a good argument. That would increase miner centralization pretty clearly. I've been saying for a while that it would also just destroy the public mempool, which is similar to what you're meaning, because you would look at the mempool and be unable to understand the real, say, for example, just even for fee estimation.
Well,
you wouldn't really understand what the actual economics are of getting a transaction on Bitcoin.
Yeah, and fee estimation is actually going to become more important, not less important, as time goes on. So, you know, we have a fixed amount of block space being, you know, produced every 10 minutes or so. If people continue to use Bitcoin more and more transactionally, then we're going to have to move things off chain. Mm-hmm. Pretty much every off chain protocol that anybody has designed or talked about for Bitcoin has some requirement of, at some point in the protocol, being able to make a layer one Bitcoin transaction and get it confirmed in a short period of time,
right?
If you're a Lightning channel and your peer broadcasts invalid state, and whether this is Lightning penalty or Lightning symmetry, you need to be able to get a transaction confirmed quickly. And if your node has no idea what the backlog looks like for miners, then you can't accurately estimate that. Mm-hmm. So I think, destroying the mempool is a bad idea. I think that there's probably always going to be out-of-band transactions. There's always going to be alternative, you know, relay mechanisms. But, you know, we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah. I saw even that SIPA nacked the data carrier size PR, which is the filter we're discussing.
Yeah.
And he made this argument. He said that the public mempool is, I forget all the exact, but it was, and it was nice because, you know, we've been saying it on Spaces, but Peter Willa saying it in the Bitcoin GitHub repo is much more powerful.
Well, and I think he also gave some really great context about, you know, this was not an oversight, right? Like there's been a thing that people have been saying, which is, Taproot transactions being able to have large amount of witness data is a bug or was a mistake. And it's not. Part of the reason why we have Taproot is to enable people to build more complex applications and contracts on top of Bitcoin. And I'm sure we're probably going to talk about OpCat at some point. Like if you do things with OpCat, you're going to have more data, you're going to have more opcodes, you're going to have bigger witnesses. And these are to build useful applications that people want. And so saying, no, we're going to shrink everything down to pay to pub key hash because, you know, we don't like images on the sacred blockchain is absurd.
Let's talk about OpCat and development. So you have a second NFT collection called Quantum Cats, which I actually want to ask you about the collection because it's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's always evolving.
It is.
But let's talk about the educational side of it. Why cat? You're talking about the quantum cats. They are cats, the images. But also you're referencing OpCat, which is a, you know, Bitcoin opcodes are what they're like programs, basically, or what functions would we call them?
They're like little operations. So you know, okay, if you imagine, Bitcoin has this little programming language called script, And when you go to spend your Bitcoin, you have to provide data to the script that's locking up your Bitcoin. And a thing in the Bitcoin core node called the script interpreter interprets the script, you know, evaluates it. And then if it returns true, then you're allowed to spend your Bitcoin. If it returns false, then you're not. So if you think about like a normal Bitcoin transaction where I send you some Bitcoin and it's like locked to your public key, and then you provide a signature over the transaction and that spends it, what's actually happening in like multisig, for example, is when I send Bitcoin to your multisig wallet, I'm actually sending it to a commitment to a little program. And then when you spend it and you provide 2 out of 3 signatures, you're providing data that makes that program evaluate to true. And that's how Bitcoin works. So, there's these little operations in Bitcoin. So we have like add, subtract, check sig, check multisig. There's some stuff for time locks for if you want to, say this can only be spent after some block height. So they're just these little operations that work on a little stack and a little bit of data that you get in a transaction. CAT is one of the original opcodes. It got deactivated by Satoshi, but it's a really, really simple operation. All programming languages have it except for script, which is like you can take two things and stick them together.
Yep.
That's all it is.
So it's like concatenate.
It's literally concatenate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so why did Satoshi deprecate? He deprecated a number of opcodes, right? But why this one?
Yeah.
There's
been speculation. So there was, the version of it that I heard and believed for a really long time, it might still be the case, is if naively implemented, there's like a little bit of a denial of service vulnerability with having CAT, because what you can do is we have 2 other opcodes in Bitcoin. One is dupe for duplicate, and then there's one to take like a SHA-256 hash of whatever element is there. So what you could do is have some data and say dupe cat, dupe cat, dupe cat, dupe cat, and it grows this thing like really, really big.
Yep.
And then you hash it. And if you make this blob of data that's super, super big and then hash it, that might take a lot of CPU on your node. And so you could make a transaction that takes too long to validate.
I see.
Now, the thing that's made me like question that a little bit is some people have gone back and dug through commits, and it looks like there was a stack size limit or stack element size limit before Satoshi removed CAT, which would
mitigate
that. Yeah. So I'm not really sure, but
so that limit would limit the number of like concatenations you could do, basically.
Yeah, basically, like you couldn't can concatenate just things up to right now in Taproot. The limit is 520 bytes, so you can have a stack element that's 520 bytes. If you try to cat one more thing onto the end of it, it fails.
So it's mitigated.
It's fine. Yeah, totally mitigated.
Yeah. What could you do though with OpCat?
Because
I've heard some really interesting things.
Wild stuff.
Well, yeah, because we'll talk in a minute about other Bitcoin upgrades and the process there too. But some of the things that I think a lot of people want are more expressive ways to encumber Bitcoin. So like covenants,
cheap
vaults, and other. And a variety of other things. But but supposedly, and this is with basically no research, just seeing what folks like you and others have said on Twitter, but you could do a lot of those things with CAT alone. Is that true?
Yeah.
What could you do?
Yeah, so we can get a flavor of covenants, and like we should talk about covenants more broadly, but like there's a flavor of covenants that you can get basically like without getting into all the gory details. Andrew Polstra came up with this really clever trick with Schnorr signatures that let you get a bunch of data about the transaction onto the stack, and you can do comparisons with it. So you can say, this is only valid if my outputs are constructed a particular way, like if it's going to a particular address or if it's spending a certain amount of Bitcoin. So you can do some like output introspection, you can do input introspection. Yeah.
That's a little bit of covenant-ish stuff.
Very much so. Like you can use it to build things that are covenant-y.
What else can you do though?
So if you want to put the covenant stuff aside.
Yeah, we'll talk about covenants more in a minute.
Yeah, some other stuff that you could do. Bitcoin annoyingly doesn't have 64-bit arithmetic. So it has 32-bit arithmetic, and Bitcoin amounts can be 50, I want to say it's like 51 or 52 bits. So if you want to like make a Bitcoin script that requires, you know, a certain amount is sent or does any kind of like math or comparison with like Bitcoin amounts, you have to start making like really unpleasant trade-offs. Like, okay, this doesn't work if you're spending more than a certain amount of Bitcoin, or it doesn't work if the granularity is too small or something. So with Cat, it seems like we could actually build what's called Big Num. Like you can build larger arithmetic. So we can do like 64-bit arithmetic, which is pretty cool. We can do Merkle tree validation, which is very useful in blockchains. Like every problem in blockchains are solved by adding a Merkle root.
It's so true.
And then, you know, the corollary to that is like every problem in blockchains is caused by one too many Merkle root. But so we can do like Merkle tree stuff. There's probably some other things that I'm forgetting. Oh, there's one more that people don't really talk about is a thing that you could do is you can force somebody to use a specific nonce in a signature, which sounds esoteric and like boring. But what's cool about that is it lets you build systems where if somebody signs the same transaction twice with like two different values, then mm-hmm. they leak their private key. So this is really interesting for things like if you have an oracle or if you have like a set of custodians or something, and you want to say, okay, for, you know, step 7 of this protocol that we have, you have to decide if we're doing A or B. And if you sign for both of them and give them to different participants, then you leak your private key.
Interesting.
And so you can
there's a penalty involved there.
You can put a bond behind that.
That's pretty
and
cool.
Say you lose your money.
That's interesting.
Which is super cool.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. Wow. So you got and you mentioned Andrew Polstra. He's the head of research at Blockstream.
Mm-hmm.
He also and you talked about script interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
He invented Miniscript, did he not? I believe.
He definitely
came to Fidelity when I was there and pitched it in like 2018 or something.
Yeah, I don't know if he invented it or if SIPA invented it.
Yeah,
it's somebody in that.
And we mentioned this, our audience may remember we had Rob Hamilton on to talk about Miniscript.
He's the most prolific Miniscript
He's the
influencer.
Miniscript guy.
He is the Miniscript guy.
But that's really interesting because Script is different than a lot of other programming languages and annoying and complicated to construct complex transactions with, but Miniscript makes it easier.
It makes it easier, and it makes it a lot more composable. Like it's Miniscript is kind of tricky to talk about because it's really, you know, a product or a tool for developers.
Yeah,
like end users should never touch or think about Miniscript. It should really be like wallet authors, application authors. Yeah. Like those people should love Miniscript. If somebody's ever like, oh man, let me put together this Miniscript to spend my Bitcoin. Like you are in a bad place.
Yeah.
Like don't put yourself there.
Hopefully we get more of wallets like what AnchorWatch is building that make it really easy to to implement. You can do complex spending condition multi-sigs, decaying multi-sigs.
Yep.
Really interesting stuff. Turns out that you didn't need upgrades for some of the stuff people thought. You just needed to know how to use Script better. And Miniscript made that possible for some of these developers.
There's some trade-offs and, you know, there's some stuff that, like a lot of the Covenant use cases, you could build today, but it ends up coming with trade-offs around either interactivity or trusting like a policy signer or something like that. And a lot of those trade-offs just aren't appropriate for what people want to build. You know, the things that we can do in Script today are we can basically encumber Bitcoin and say, you know, I want to specify who can spend this and when they can spend it. So you get who and when, but you don't get like where or how, right? And for a lot of applications, whether it's like a UTXO sharing thing or a vault or a bridge to a sidechain or something else, you need to be able to put constraints on, you know, these are the valid places that the money is allowed to go under what circumstances. And right now in Bitcoin, if you can satisfy the script, which means, you know, some combination of signatures, hash locks, and time locks, the money can go wherever you choose. And there's nothing that we can really do about that. So all of the solutions to sort of do covenants without covenants involves saying, okay, well, we're going to have another key. It's going to be part of a multi-sig, and that key is going to be in a policy signer. And the policy signer only signs if you satisfy this program, right,
so
or something.
So it's an off-chain
exactly.
part of the protocol.
Yep.
All right, let's talk briefly about covenants mm-hmm. more broadly. You know, I worked with Sam Abbasi, who did some work on covenants. He, I think, wrote one of the original Vault papers with Kanger and mm-hmm. A couple other people, Spencer Hommel, I think. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking at this for several years, but it's become a bigger – I certainly haven't been looking at it as long as someone like Jeremy Rubin.
Mm-hmm.
He's the author of BIP 119, which is the – I guess the proposal to add a new opcode, check, yep. template, verify.
Yep.
There's others. There's OpVault, which is effectively a covenant, right, yep. from James O'Byrne. I think yep. there may even be others that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, there's a whole class of them.
And these, we've already kind of said it, but just to put the nail on the head, hit the nail on the head, covenants allow, they expand the ways that you can encumber Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's definitely the idea. And you know, getting back to, you mentioned Quantum Cats. Like,
yeah.
The reason why we did that collection and the reason why we're talking about it is we strongly believe that Bitcoin needs something like covenants.
Yeah, it needs.
And it needs something. And that conversation had stalled out, I think, is fair. And, you know, we looked at what are the covenant proposals out there. And there's sort of like a Venn diagram to draw. There's like, what are the covenant proposals that are out there that aren't insane? What are the kinds of things that people want to like build with Bitcoin? And, you know, because there's things that there's proposals that people have made that don't actually address any market need, right? And then there's like things that people want to build that can't be built with covenants or can't be built with anything that we have a concrete design for. And then there's sort of a third bubble, which is like, what are things that we think are in the space of possibility to be activated,
right?
Because actually having code review done and having people understand it and getting the community behind it is a process. And you know, we did some analysis and you know, we think that CAT is a really good candidate. We, you know, think Bitcoin needs covenants generally. And so if it's not CAT, but it's something that gives us the functionality that we think Bitcoin needs, like that's great. But yeah. But we're big fans of CAT because it's simple, it's powerful, it's sort of semantically dense. Like it lets you do a lot with a little bit. And so you know, CAT
is— And it's already written, right? Satoshi invented it.
Yeah, I mean like the current patch is it's not just like undoing his code, like it's new code.
It's not Control-Z.
But yeah, it's not just Control-Z, but you know, like the guts of the patch, like the yeah. where the rubber meets the road is like 10 lines of code.
Interesting.
And so, you know, like Andrew was doing a podcast with somebody and he like read it while he was talking. He's like, yep, yeah. I can see exactly what this does.
There's
and
that it, guy Song a Day Man. He sang it, right?
He sang it. And then we just did a little mission with the Quantum Cats community
yep.
where we asked people to explain that code in like an accessible way. And so people made songs and videos and tutorials and all these things that walked through line by line because it's 10 lines of code. So you can actually explain it. You know, some people have complained that, you know, the implications of CAT are more complex than 10 lines of code. But I do think it's a valid point that, you know, if you look at other proposed changes to Bitcoin that are like 70,000 lines of code,
yeah.
you're never going to read that and really understand what it does versus, you know, this.
Yeah, it's simple in yeah. that way. It doesn't mean it's not powerful, positive or negative, but it's simple.
Simple.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, okay, we're going to talk about Taproot Wizards and Quantum Dots. Sure. We're finally going to get there in a minute, but I still want to talk to you more yeah. about upgrading Bitcoin. I saw Ava Chow had started a discussion in the, she's a Bitcoin developer, mm-hmm. had started a discussion in the Bitcoin dev mailing list just a couple weeks ago, saying that, well, I would say first addressing the concept that the Bitcoin improvement proposal process, the BIP process,
yes.
Is clunky, it's not really working, but even more than that, it has its own repo
yep.
That Luke Dash Jr. is the moderator for admin, what mm-hmm. was it, admin, is that
yeah,
right?
his sort of official title under the auspices of that process is that he's the BIP editor.
He's the BIP editor. He's yep. the only one, though, that has the ability at the moment to assign BIP numbers and approve, like, submit pull requests into the repo to get them added?
Yeah, something like that. I think technically there's other people who have permissions over the repo. But, you know, by the self-imposed rules of this process.
The convention.
By the convention of this process, and whether or not it's a good convention, whether or not we should continue the convention is like a different question. But under the convention, you know, the way that this is supposed to work is you have an idea for a Bitcoin, you know, improvement. And it doesn't have to be like a consensus change.
Right.
Like, you know, Craig Raw, who made Sparrow Wallet, wrote a BIP for a standardized format to export address labels, right? So like you label your transactions in a wallet, you want to export them and import them into another one, there's a BIP for that.
Now, so all the other wallets can implement it the same
exactly.
way and it can work everywhere.
It's a standardization and like communication
mechanism. Even like, right, or BIP32, which is what the
higher HD mnemonics.
Yeah,
the mnemonics is 39.
Right, that's not a consensus change.
Exactly.
It's other stuff. So it doesn't have to be upgrading the network, quote unquote.
No.
It's Bitcoin related.
It's something Bitcoin related. And like there's been a lot of controversy because Casey wrote a BIP for ordinals and
mostly just what documentation.
Yeah. So if other people want to write, you know, another implementation, like a compatible implementation, there's one document.
I see. You mean for the ORD software,
you could
write a different version of that software, mm-hmm. but make sure it works.
Yeah, exactly. It's a specification. So like I want to find like the authoritative specification for this. The BIP repo is well known. You can link to it. A lot of people copy it, et cetera.
Right.
So, you know, how it's supposed to work is like you start a conversation, you know, with people on the mailing list, get some feedback. You draft your BIP and then you, you know, submit it to the repo. And what the BIP editor is supposed to do is, you know, look and see like, is this actually about Bitcoin? Is it, There's some nebulous
the format
criteria.
You're supposed to put the text in literally.
Yeah, right? There's like sections that you're supposed to have, but then there's also like it's supposed to be I don't remember the wording, but it's supposed to be like a good thing for Bitcoin, and like that's where there's been some
But the
stuff,
but the idea but, on its face makes some sense. It's not supposed to be an attack to Bitcoin. Quote
yeah, or it's not supposed to be like about Ethereum. Or
but
something,
even if
right? it's supposed to be about Bitcoin,
but even and as so, I say that, an attack, you could imagine the current sole BIP editor views ordinals as an attack on Bitcoin.
He sure does, which is interesting.
Unfortunate.
And so what's supposed to happen is, you know, BIP editor assigns a number to it, and that number doesn't mean it's approved, it doesn't mean it's blessed, it doesn't mean that it's, you know, fast track for implementation. It's just a numbering scheme, and we don't want two different things to have the same number. That's
for organizational purposes.
That's it.
Yeah.
And you know, this has become a bottleneck where, you know, several Bitcoin developers have said, you know, I can't move forward with my work because other parts of the ecosystem want me to have a BIP number.
Yeah, they're not aware. Like, I need to broadcast formally that this is a project.
Well, you know, in some software projects, it's like when you want to turn on a specific feature, you tell it, like, what BIP number are you turning on? And so if you don't have a number, there's not something to put in the field.
Oh, it's that thing that Reindel sent over the mailing list on this date. It's like, come on.
So it's just
a
format. It's this thing where, you know, through some combination of, you know, Luke is a busy guy. He's got other responsibilities. But I think there's also just some amount of, like, politicking involved.
A little bit of consternation with his editorial work, quote, unquote.
I think so.
But he does say, in his defense, he says he's just straight up too busy to stay on top of it.
Yeah,
I was reading this thread, and he's mostly copacetic to adding somebody, it sounds like, or some people.
I mean, I think that's a defensible position, but I think it's also reasonable to expect that picking a number out of the available set of numbers and like saying here's your number now shouldn't be
it's pretty straightforward.
A time consuming process.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's I'm actually thinking maybe it should just be something that's completely automated and there shouldn't be humans in the loop.
There was
at all.
Some discussion about that if it could be automated. Some names were put forth, not that I care much. They all sounded pretty decent to me, but Roast Beef. If my audience doesn't know who I'm referring to, that's kind of funny. Merge,
yeah.
Roast Beef. I saw Matt Corallo, somebody nominated. Either way, though,
I think those are all great contributors to Bitcoin, and like those are all great people to put in a position of responsibility. I think that maybe the fact that there's a whole mailing list discussion about like who the BIP editor should be means that people are projecting more power and responsibility onto this role than there should be.
Yeah.
Like, because something that's really interesting about the whole BIP process that people don't quite understand is that a BIP does not have to be marked as accepted in order for it to happen, right? So PayNIMS, which is like what Samurai Wallet uses to do like more private on-chain sending, that's BIP, I think it's 47, and the current status of that BIP is unanimously discouraged for implementation. So like the BIP says, don't do this, mm-hmm. and a bunch of wallets do it anyway, and their users are happy with it, right? There's also BIPs that are accepted or finalized that like have never seen the light of day. And so, you know, this repo should just be about aggregating documents and making them discoverable and making them findable. If that's not the job that's being done, then like we should do something different. And saying, you know, oh, well, I need to make sure that only, you know, the people with the right, you know, moral character are in charge of assigning that. Like, it's insanity.
Or like GitHub commit history even. Because,
like, who cares?
To your point, this is, frankly, almost like a repo maintainer. It is a repo maintainer, by the way.
Yes.
But even like a Bitcoin core maintainer, it's mostly a janitorial role, or it's supposed to be, right? It's not, no value judgment is supposed to be made by the BIP editor when assigning a number.
Well, and like, I think.
Right, that process is orthogonal. It's yes. when the broader Bitcoin open source community gets together and achieves a consensus on adding something to Bitcoin, it may or may not come from the BIP repo, basically.
Yeah.
It has nothing, no real direct connection.
That's right.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because for such a famously decentralized project, and on the developer side, it certainly is, in my opinion, but to have sort of innovated in early on, what is it, like BIP 1 or 2 is the description of the BIP process.
Yeah.
Like
BIP 2, yeah.
Like this is a governance process, mm-hmm. effectively, but of course it's totally ungovernable. Like there isn't really much governance happening at all. And other projects like Ethereum have actually sort of mirrored this. They call mm-hmm. them EIPs.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but of course they I would say it's not as decentralized from a development standpoint. So they actually achieve more with their EIP repository.
Well, and I think that it's totally reasonable to say for, you know, changes to this software or changes to the protocol, here's a process that we want to have just to keep things orderly. And, you know, we don't want people writing like really garbage specification documents. So there's going to be somebody that helps you with like copy editing,
like
finding
quality
references,
control,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I would argue that a lot of that ends up being like the ultimate responsibility of the person who's proposing the improvement. So, you know, if you want your proposal to be well received, then it should be well written and easy to understand and have like good references and good links and, you know, reference implementation, like all these things. The thing that's like specifically getting people wrapped around the axle right now is assigning a number, which is like such an inconsequential
right.
thing that, you know,
just give them all a number.
I mean, I've been joking with people that we should just say like, let's just inscribe BIPs. They have a natural number, like they
there
live forever.
There you go. Forever. It's BIP, like, you know, 62,450, whatever.
Yeah, you know, computers are really good at keeping track of big numbers. Like, you don't have to remember it. Like, your computer will.
But you'll be able to reference it. And by the way, anyone with a copy of the blockchain
can
pull it.
That's right.
And look at it on.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's like built-in access control. Like, you want to push an update to your BIP, reinscribe it. You're the only person who can do it. You have the keys.
Let's talk. We could go on and on here. I love this conversation, but it is a little wonkish in the Bitcoin world. So
sure.
let's talk about Taproot Wizards and what you guys are working on. You have these two collections. Have you given away any? I've seen you've given away some of the Taproot Wizards mm-hmm. to contributors, to notable. I think Arthur Hayes has one. That's a pretty good one.
His is awesome.
Yeah, it is. Have you actually done the drop?
Nope.
I didn't think so, right?
Nope.
So you've got a bunch of people that have amassed some points from completing these quests, mm-hmm. But you haven't yet actually done the mint or whatever. You've done the mint, sorry. You can see them all inscribed. You haven't, delivered them or sold them either.
Like to
some people say that I've heard this criticism that like Taproot Wizards is like making all this money selling JPEGs, and I was like, I'm pretty sure they haven't actually sold any
of them. Yeah the only JPEGs that we've sold, and technically they're not even JPEGs, they're HTML files, are the Quantum Cats.
Yeah,
So, you know,
right, like, that I, you did do a mint for.
We did. Yeah. I mean, like, I think the mint terminology is like sometimes a little bit confusing, especially with inscriptions. So, like, I would just say the primary sale.
Yeah.
Right. So, we've done a primary sale of Quantum Cats. We have not for Taproot Wizards. Some people have gotten Taproot Wizards in other ways. There have been like these honoraries,
like Nick Carter.
Nick Carter and
Dennis Porteau.
Yep, Dennis.
He's the op return king.
Yep, Jeremy Rubin.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of them. And then also, like, some people in the community have gotten wizards for, you know, various things. And there's going to be lots more ways to get wizards in the future. And, you know, like, some of the Quantum Cats, you mentioned that they evolve. Like,
yeah.
One of the evolutions that people have seen is some number of them, two so far, have these gold capes that you'll be able to use to get a wizard in the future.
So, yeah, so you haven't sold the Taproot Wizards, but that's made a big splash because they're based on iconic Bitcoin iconography, and some very prominent people have them, and they are cool.
I think the four megger was kind of like a moment in Bitcoin. And
now
and
there's a term now. That's things. What they say. The inscribers they say you guys ripped a four megger.
Ripped a four megger.
Yeah, it's that's pretty right. big.
Yeah.
But the cats. Let's talk about the cats too, because this enabled use some of the. I don't know, more advanced inscription, I'm going to say technologies, but it's almost sort of strategies, right? It's not like the, so you use recursion, right? Which is, you can have one inscription linked to another inscription, another inscription. What is this? Okay, so one, it's sort of honorary or educational about OpCat. There's light and dark Quantum Cats?
Yeah, there's dead and alive. Because like Quantum Cats, there's this like Schrodinger's cat, right? So they're dead or alive. It's also a little bit of a commentary on OpCat itself.
Right, because, like, do you like it or do you not like it?
Well, but also it's like kind of alive and dead, right? Like it's not active on the network, but it used to be. There's a proposal out there to reactivate it. So like OpCat is kind of in this weird quantum state, and we're going to find out, you know, probably sooner than later whether or not OpCat is alive or not, right? So like the quantum state thing is commentary on OpCat itself.
And there are things that how do they evolve? How is that? Because saw you were saying on X.com that that you don't know. You guys can't necessarily predict how they would evolve. Like, what are the inputs that result in evolution, or how does this? What is that?
So each cat is made up of layers, so they're stacked on top of each other. So, you know, the background is the bottom, and then there's like a cat body on top of it, and then there's cat eyes on top of that, and it layers up. So what we did was, you know, when you have a cat in your wallet, the inscription that you're looking at is an HTML file that uses recursion to point at a bunch of other inscriptions. And, you know, I'm going to gloss over some details, but basically what it does is it tries to pull in all of its layers. And all of the data for all of these layers, so all of the data for the images was inscribed months ago, but it's encrypted and sitting on chain, so nobody can go and look and see like, oh, this is the next thing. But it's there. The data is already there. And so then what ends up happening is when a trait gets revealed, there's an inscription that sort of links the individual cat to this blob of encrypted data and provides a decryption key. And now that HTML file is able to pull in the next layer and
interesting.
So that's how it works.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I don't know of any other NFTs really that evolve. I know of obviously, you know, like ArtBlocks NFTs, a lot of them are animated, right? They have many frames, but it's pretty kind of cool.
Yeah, and like there's a bunch of other inscriptions collections that have done a similar technique for like a delayed reveal. So like you buy a thing and you don't know what it is until like they push a button and then you see it.
Yeah.
There are also other inscriptions that have the capability to like evolve and change. But the way that those work is it'll be like the artist or the project is like uploading new art and then like they change. What's cool about this approach is we had to pre-commit to all of the art before we inscribed any of the cats. And so as time goes on and as the cats evolve, you know, you have to know that we planned this from the start. And, you know, like my hope is that people are pleasantly surprised by some of the things that happened to the cats, and knowing that it was sort of like all orchestrated from the start is like part of the art.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
What else does the Taproot Wizards company, right?
Yeah, it's a company. Yeah.
It is a venture-backed startup, venture-backed Bitcoin startup.
We are.
What else do you guys have planned? Is it more NFT collections? Is there I had read at one point that there was a report, I don't know, but maybe you can tell us, of plans to build some kind of scaling technology, whether that's a roll-up. I mean, that's people love roll-ups now.
Yeah, everybody loves roll-ups these days. We are, you know, we're trying to make Bitcoin magical in our own way. We are trying to do that by building products and services, you know, for Bitcoin. So far, the first two that we've done have been Ordinals projects. But we're very interested in other platforms and products that let people use their Bitcoin in like new and fun ways. So, you know, I'm very interested. The company is very interested in off-chain execution. I think we need that generally in Bitcoin for scalability, for more functionality, and for privacy. I think one of the things that's an interesting opportunity with Ordinals is that the Ordinals community is, I think, almost 100%, if not 100%, non-custodial. Like, people don't custodially trade Ordinals.
Holds
their keys.
I don't know if there are any Bitcoin custodians that, I guess, does Binance now, maybe?
So they...
Maybe as an exchange, they...
They do it for BRC-20s.
Yeah, but not actually for collections.
They do it for collections.
Yeah, but okay, you're absolutely right.
So it's this thing, right, where, you know, one of the challenges, right, is if you're building, whether it's an L2 or some interesting new like multi-party protocol for L1 stuff, you know, your total addressable market is like not just everybody who has Bitcoin. It's like people who have Bitcoin who can like use your tool and like actually want to pay money for it.
Not even people that are self-custodying, even smaller than that group, right? People
That's
that
right.
are comfortable going on-chain and doing more advanced self-custody activities.
You gotta go dig the crypto steel out of your backyard and like
you can't
Bitcoin,
just like
right?
lock it down there.
And so it's this thing where like the Ordinals community is this really interesting subset of Bitcoin users where they're all self-custodying. They've demonstrated willingness to pay for things that help them do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And they've demonstrated that they're willing to use early software even if it has subpar UX, if it lets them do what they want to do with their Bitcoin, right? Like when Ordinals popped off, people were, compiling the Ord command line application in order to like inscribe and trade inscriptions.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have this like incredibly active and engaged group of Bitcoiners that you can build things for. Get really, really good, fast validation about like product market fit, economic viability, technical viability. And then if those things that you build are generalizable outside of Ordinals use cases, then you don't have to go and like build something with no usage for 5 years and then launch and somehow hope to compete with Visa. You can actually build for happy paying customers on day one, grow things incrementally. And then if it ends up only being a thing for the Ordinals community, that's great. You can still have a great business that way. But if it ends up becoming like bigger or more interesting, like that's even better. And so, we're looking at a lot of, people try to categorize what different scaling solutions are. I think especially when we get covenants on Bitcoin, the kinds of scaling and off-chain execution systems that people build aren't going to look exactly like analogs in Ethereum or other places. So people are going to say, oh, it's a roll-up or oh, it's whatever. I think we need new words, but we're interested in those kinds of projects.
And just lastly, Rindell, when you talk about using your NIM here, when you talk about making Bitcoin magical again, a lot of what I hear is making it more programmable and usable in some ways. what's your long-term end goal, vision for what Bitcoin could become if you guys are, you know, broadly successful?
You know, I think it's like Bitcoin is internet money, right? It's the native currency of the internet. And it's you know, there's this this moment that I had in my own Bitcoin journey where I you know, I'm a software developer. I built a little like web app that you could come and make an API call, and I'd ask you for some Bitcoin, and you'd send it to me, and then I would like vend the service. And I had this aha moment of, okay, we've got open source web servers, mail servers, database servers, caching servers. Bitcoin is like the open source money server, right? And it's this thing where you know, the LAMP stack in like web development, it let anybody anywhere in the world build whatever they want and reach like a global audience without asking for permission or having to do anything special. And, you know, beyond the sort of inflation monetary properties of Bitcoin, which are really important for like its growth and its value, I think like an underappreciated special power that Bitcoin has is that it's permissionless internet money. And I think also, you know, frankly, if your goal is to really separate money from state, you can't have Bitcoin just being digital gold. Like, the state is not afraid of gold, right? They're not. Like, gold does not compete with the US dollar. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, if you actually had permissionless internet money that everyone everywhere in the world, you know, was using all the time because it's like deeply integrated underneath like applications that people are using every day, that actually is something that gives the dollar a run for its money. Like, that actually is something that can move the money on separating money from state. So I think it's something where you know, your money is only as useful as the number of people that you can like trade it with for buying goods and services. And I think, you know, right now, for better or worse, for most people, the most useful thing that you can do with Bitcoin is like buy it, not touch it for 10 years, and then sell it. And I would like for Bitcoin to be more useful for more kinds of economic activity. And because of the limitations that we have in order to keep the kind of decentralization that's important in Bitcoin, you're not going to do all that on chain, which means we have to get more transactions off chain, which means we need more programmable Bitcoin.
Ryan Dell, CTO of Taproot Wizards, thank you for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thanks to our guest Ryan Dell, CTO of Taproot Wizards, and our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading, as always. We will check you next week. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at @glxyresearch. See you next week.